Welcome to today's edition of Time in the Vineyard with pastor-teacher Jeff Torin. Today's broadcast is being brought to you from the pulpit of Liberty Valley Church, Northfield, Ohio.
Joel chapter 1, and we'll begin reading in verse 1. The word of the Lord that came to Joel, the son of Pethuel, "Hear this, ye old men, and give ear, all ye inhabitants of the land. Hath this been in your days, or even in the days of your fathers? Tell ye your children of it. Let your children tell their children, and their children another generation. That which the palmer worm hath left, hath the locust eaten. And that which the locust hath left, hath the canker worm eaten. And that which the canker worm hath left, hath the caterpillar eaten." It kind of dawned on me as I was looking, asking the Lord for where we should go as a church in a new series. You know, we teach through books here in the context, verse by verse, chapter by chapter, so that it's taught in its entirety and in the context. But as you're going through these things and you want to be led by the Spirit where to go, you want to feed the sheep, the whole flock, with a well-rounded diet, so you don't want to spend too much time in the Old Testament. You want to kind of move around Old Testament, New Testament, Psalms, Proverbs, and things like that. And I just kind of felt like this is where we probably should go. And it's interesting because we received a phone call this week from a radio listener that was just peculiar. And it reminded me that the different flocks are vastly different. The different shepherds within the flocks are vastly different. And a lot of the end time teaching is not done, just isn't there. Some of you listen to Christian radio or Christian things, and there's just not a whole lot of end time teaching. And you get quite a bit of it here. So I was reflecting and thinking, well, maybe I'm off balance. Maybe everybody else is doing, you know, and maybe we're off balance. So I kind of started in a little bit, and then I felt like I got the encouragement that was, yeah, you're okay. Because one of the commentators said, he reminded us, and he said, it's interesting that one-fourth of the whole New Testament talks about the coming day of Jesus Christ. A whole fourth of the teachings of the New Testament are talking about the crescendo of all history, the return of Jesus Christ in power and in glory, and the surrounding plans that take place in order to get us to that situation in a political, geopolitical, global way. So we're going to take a look here then at Joel. And it would be an eschatological book, a book of eschatology, the study of the last things, a study of the end. And there's more to it than that in there, of course. There's just normal sociology, human beings that God is working through and for and to and in these ways. So what I'd like to do is then we started out here in Joel, and to set this up as far as the sociology of it and the human behavior of it and the thinking of what here we're about to embark on, I'd like you to throw your ribbon in here and go over to the history in 1 Chronicles chapter 12, and we'll find something that kind of lays a thread down for it, I would say, even through the whole book of Joel. And it's also easier for us to relate to because these are just men in history, and so are we. We are men and women in history who are making our mark. Whether good or bad, mediocre or large, we are making a mark in our history. This is the plan that God has chosen. When we look into 1 Chronicles, we enter into the history about 1,000 or so B.C., and there is a transition taking place. The good king, King David, who I covet to be in this territory to teach about, is being handed the crown. In our chapter here of chapter 12, right around verse 23, we have the changing of the guard. It says in verse 23, "And these are the numbers of the bands that were ready armed to war, and came to David to Hebron, to turn the kingdom of Saul to him, according to the word of the Lord." Now again, this is historical dynasty changing. This is a political administration that is changing, and it looks as though it just kind of fell into place if you were an onlooker. But we know in this first verse that it changes, it says, according to the word of the Lord. And so we have a new king now, David, a new dynasty, a new administration. And what he does is then he begins to do a list of the significant, notable men that were around in this administration. Notice in 24 it says, the children of Judah that bear shield and spear were 6,000. So these registers, we're going to notice, are tribal. It says the children or the tribe of Judah, the family. He's setting a pattern here. The children of Judah that bear shield and spear were 6,800 ready armed to war. The children of Simeon, or tribe of Simeon, mighty men of valor for the war, 7,100. Then in verses 26 through 28, he says something a little bit peculiar to those of you who are students of the Bible. I always try to implore you to be students of the Bible. You need to read your Bibles. You need to study your Bibles. You can't let them just sit on a shelf. We need to be students of the book. Because otherwise you miss very important things as you're reading through. And in these next few verses, 26, 27, and 28, he says something interesting about these particular tribes. Notice, it says in verse 26, and of the children of Levi, 4,600. And Jehoiada was the leader of the Ammonites. Now, what's happening is he is going to go through this list of men, this register of the tribes that are a part of the administration, and notice that so far it's talking about men of war. He's talking of in a military sense in some ways, but men of war. Now, when we come down to verse 26, 27, and 28, we're talking about the tribe of Levi. The tribe of Levi, you wouldn't think are men of war, because we already are familiar, being students of the Bible, that the men of Levi are who? They're the priests. So what we're finding here is something very interesting. These are what we would call the men of the cloth. The men of the cloth at this point are setting down their collars and picking up their arms. So something similar in the day of our revolution. We had men standing behind pulpits who wore black robes. But beneath the black robe, as they stood in the pulpit, they had military uniforms on and their guns and their swords by their side beneath the very black robes they were preaching in. So what we see here then is something interesting, because why is this? In fact, look at it in 27. He says, and Jehoiada. Now we know who Jehoiada is. It says, and Jehoiada was the, look what he calls them. He's not listed as the priests. In fact, it says, and Jehoiada was the leader of the Aaronites. That's peculiar. We know who the people, the children of Aaron, were. They were the priests, but they're not called priests here. He's the leader of the Aaronites, as if you don't know. And look at it, it says, and with him were 3,700. Verse 28, similarly, there's specifically a young man. And Zadok, it says, a young man mighty of valor. We know who Zadok is. He's a priest. But now he's not described as a priest. He's actually famous in the pages of the Bible for King David as his priest. He's called a young man mighty of valor. And look at it, it says, and of his father's house, 22 captains. You know what that means? That means within this priesthood family of the Aaronites or of the Levites, it says that there were in his father's house, in other words, his brothers were fierce. Not only was this priest a priest and the children of Aaron who worked in the temple as a person of the cloth, his brothers, the whole family were tough. They were fierce men. It says many men of valor, and even at a young age. Now, you think of that at a young age, because our culture is designed to eliminate the people of valor who are of young age. The devil is behind trying to make people who are youngsters useless. We have been tarnished by this thinking. Let me illustrate.
On December 7th, 1941, we all know what happened. The Japanese came in hordes through the sky to bomb Pearl Harbor, and they dropped a tremendous amount of bombs. But it was at that time that a certain man of young valor, two in particular, found out that this was happening, got into their car, and raced toward their plane to get into a plane at 21 years old. Now, you have to think, do you know a 21-year-old boy? Don't they seem a little bit young? Talk to the boys, 19, 20 years old. Do they seem the kind that are going to drive over around 90-some miles an hour in their Buick? And some of you have seen the movie. Now, the story actually goes that they were wearing their tuxedo pants because they were out on a flute all night long. So they actually did this in their tuxedo pants. But still, they drove all that way racing to jump into their plane, to get in. They didn't even have time to fully arm the plane. Take off, immediately are taking on gunfire from above. Fly, take down a few of the Japanese, land their plane to reload with guns, with bullets and munitions, only to take off again and risk their lives to take down a few more Japanese planes before they actually successfully land the plane for a second time and live. What's interesting is that the major of the bunch, the one who was an older boy at 23, much older, was denied the Medal of Honor because he didn't have authorization to fly. Men like this that are young men of valor don't need orders. They immediately got into their car, flew down the road, called in advance, prepare my planes so that I can take off upon my own thinking, because this is the right thing to do. We are under attack. Get into the plane, start fighting back. And so he takes a bullet through the canopy and into his arm and takes shrapnel into his knee. He's wounded, yet still flying, wounded and shot, shooting down the Japanese. And when they come to give him the Medal of Honor, he's denied because, well, some actually say that he was ordered to stand down and denied it. Got into his plane and fought anyway. That is what we're looking at here as a young man who is a priest. Zadok, a young man of mighty of valor and of his father's house, his brothers, nasty ones as well. 20 and two captains. The men of this caliber don't need orders. They know what to do. And do you ever notice that if you're in a group, there are certain men that rise to the top? They don't need to be told what to do. They know what to do. And not only do they know what to do, they do it. While the bulk of people need to be told what to do and still won't do it, that's the difference between men and men of valor. These men didn't need to be ordered. They knew. They understood. This is what we're here for. Risk our lives for the king's sake and our sake, the president. That's when we come into the next tribe that we're a little more familiar with in verse 32. And of the children or tribe of Issachar, which were men that had understanding of the times. In all thy getting, get understanding. Get wisdom, it's the principal thing. Get understanding. So that you can understand, it says, that these men of Issachar were men that had understanding of the times. They knew the surroundings to know what Israel ought to do. These men had understanding of what the Bible calls dark sentences, difficult passages, riddles, parables. They were thinking men that were above and beyond the average men. They would develop a very acute way of perceiving things. They could walk into a room and read the crowd, read the room, read the audience, and figure where to go and how to speak and what to do. These would be the men that would come to the top and rise to be CEOs of their corporation. Men of valor. Their senses were exercised by the word of God so that they would understand not only what to do, but what all Israel, God's nation, should do. What should we do as God's people specifically?
They didn't need orders. Get in the plane and defend the harbor.
When we come to Joel, this is what we're looking at.
Because history is the same. You need men of valor then. You need men of valor now. And we will have men of valor in the future.
And what we're looking at here is a state of emergency. The book of Joel in a whole is in a state of an emergency. There is a catastrophe that has been unleashed, and so there has been a red alert sent out. The sirens have blown. In fact, if you looked in the chapter 2 and verse 1, he says, "Blow ye the trumpet in Zion, sound an alarm in my holy mountain." So if you just kind of back through some of these things, the draft is actually reinstated. So if you look at verse 14, he says, "Sanctify ye a fast, call a solemn assembly, gather the elders and all the inhabitants of the land." So we're gathering everyone around because we're in a state of emergency. We're going to gather the elders specifically because they need to then be able to transfer the information from the elders to the general public. We also have, if you back up into verse 13, he says, "Look at it, gird yourselves and lament, ye priests, and howl, ye ministers of the altar." Part of the reinstatement here, again, is the priests. That blows apart the whole Quaker idea of being pacifists. Brothers, we are not pacifists. If somebody breaks into your home, grab your gun or a knife and defend your home. The ministers themselves are called to order. They're called to attention. In fact, the farmers, this is such a moment of catastrophe, that in verse 11 he says to the farmers, "Be ashamed, O ye husbandmen, howl, O ye vine dressers." So we have the elders, we have the general population, we need the ministers, we need the farmers. And it is so bad, we're going to go to the bars and honky-tonks to pull the men out that are of redneck. Look at that in verse 3. "Awake, ye drunkards, and weep, and howl, all ye drinkers of wine." All hands on deck. Everybody needs to be involved. Why? Well, we're told. Verse 4. There's an invasion of insects, actually. Now look what it says. Verse 4, "That which the palmer worm hath left, hath the locust eaten. And that which the locust hath left, hath the canker worm eaten. And that which the canker worm hath left, the caterpillar has eaten." Now in the Hebrew, that is a poem, so that it would remind us. It's of emphasis. So, you know, you're taught to speak. There's certain syllables that you would say as you speak. Hitler was the master of speaking with this kind of speech. He would say things in a rhetorical way. His rhetoric would be measured in a rhythmic way when he would shake and then bang his pulpit and do these things. It's just the nature of speaking. God is a speaking God. And so in this manner, when he alerts them of this emergency, it's actually written. So to us, it seems kind of a little bit foreign because it's translated from the Hebrew into the English, but it is in a poetic way, a rhythmic way. He says, "That which the palmer worm hath left, the locust has eaten." And you can see in your mind, now what we have is a swarm, a devastating plague of locusts. They have eaten all the fruit and foliage. They're even, it says, they were gnawing at the very stems of everything. How it works with locusts is if we've seen cicada, we see grasshoppers, which it's actually going to describe. They kind of look like a grasshopper or winged kind of creature, a locust. But what happens is we have these all the time. But what will happen, at least the scientists have taught, that when this happens, if they are born out of their eggs at a certain distance, they're normal. But if they're born and they out of the eggs at a certain closeness where they start to touch one another, it literally will change the makeup of the locust. Physically, they'll actually change color. But they'll behave totally differently. They'll start to merge together as a band. Almost what we see on TV, you know, when we see the Chinese Red Army marching in row after row after row, never losing a beat of their march. The locust actually begins to do this, and they will hop over each other in rows and in ranks, will begin to waste all the foliage. Anything green will be totally devastated. And he says this in rows. That's why
Whatever the palma worm hasn't eaten, the locust will eat what's left. And that which the locust has eaten and has left, the cankerworm will take that out. And just in case there's anything at all left, that which the cankerworm hath left, the caterpillar has eaten. So what he is now illustrating of something that has happened in Joel's day is a total devastation. The land is completely desolate. And it actually gets worse if you were to jump down to verse 18, because all the foliage is gone, the ecosystem itself is completely crushed. And of course, then that will wreck the chain. So verse 18, how do the beasts groan? The cattle, the herds of cattle, they're perplexed. Why? Because they have no pasture. Yea, the flocks of sheep are made desolate. They're starving to death. If you have nothing green, there's nothing for the animals to eat. So the animals are starving to death and perplexed. You've seen this where the cows, you can count the rib cage of the cows as they lay there and squeal in ways of dying. And of course, we know what happens after that. That then, what we know, remember in history, that of the dust bowl. And it just so happens to this time, on top of all these things, there's a drought to make it worse. Verse 19, O Lord, to thee will I cry, for the fire hath devoured the pastures of the wilderness, and the flame hath burned all the trees of the field. So there's sparks, now we have a drought, we have a plague, and now we have forest fires. The land is scorched. So we have to stop and say, wait a minute here. This really happened. This isn't a movie. This isn't fictitious. This isn't allegory. So you have to stop and say, wait a minute. What is going on here? That's why you have verse 2. And then we can run down through all these things. Look at it in 2. Joel says, hear this, you old men, give ear, all ye inhabitants of the land. Hath this been in your days? You know what he does? He gathers everybody together and he goes, have you ever seen anything like this before? I mean, have you ever seen this before? Have you ever heard of anything like this before? And he's asking the old men because they have lived a lot longer, and the elderly men have seen and done things that we have never seen or done. You know, I mean, we never put cardboard in our shoes because we were so poor that you had to have cardboard in your shoes because you didn't have soles. We've never experienced anything like that. You've heard the stories. I think my grandmother had to put cups of water in the corn to make it last further to feed 5 girls because they didn't have enough money for corn. Have you ever put water in your corn to make it last further? We've never experienced anything like that. We've never experienced anything like the Depression. We have been spoiled our whole lives. And so Joel here is seeing this massive drought and this plague and forest fires. He sees absolute catastrophe going on. And what does he say? He calls the old men. Have you ever seen anything like this before? What's going on? Tell your children of it. So look what he does as we go through. He says in 5, awake ye drunkards and weep and howl, ye drinkers of wine, because the new wine, it's cut off from your mouth. All the fun that you've been living is over. For look at this, a nation is come up upon my land. It's interesting that Joel calls them a nation. Now you're students of the Bible. You're reading through Joel. And you say, now wait a minute here. We're looking at locusts and bugs and insects. And the picture is being painted by the prophet. And he says, a nation has come up upon my land, look at it, strong and without number, whose teeth are the teeth of a lion. And he hath the cheek teeth of a great lion. That shows the picture, doesn't it? Grasshoppers or locusts with these teeth. You ever notice when you have like a carcass laying in the woods or something? Even a raccoon
and you kind of take a stick as a boy, you know, you all did when you were kids. Girls, you know, I don't know, you're like, that's gross. But the boys are like, let's take a stick and poke this thing, you know, and let's cut its head off and see what's inside, and, you know, let's see. You take a stick and you open its mouth, you're like, look at those teeth. It's picturesque. He's saying, these creatures have teeth like a lion. Now, some of you are already thinking, there's a prophetical teaching about something about teeth. Iron teeth. Some of you don't know, because you're not students of the Bible. So you'll read through this, and you won't know. And there's hordes of churches that never get taught any prophecy at all, and none of them will ever know. So don't be embarrassed, because some of you are in good company with the masses. Nobody knows things unless we're taught. That's why we have preaching and teaching from a pulpit that takes the Bible in its context and teaches it. Verse 7, he hath laid my vine waste, and look at it, he barked my fig tree. He's talking of the locusts and these bugs. They barked my fig tree. They ate all the bark off the tree. He hath made it clean, bare, and cast it away. The branches thereof are made white, totally gnawing at the stems. All the green is gone, but the very stems and sticks now are being gnawed away. Verse 9, the meat offering and the drink offering is cut off from the house of the Lord. You can't even do religious function anymore. There's nothing to eat. There's nothing to drink. The priests, the Lord's ministers, they're in mourning. The field is wasted. The land is mourning. The corn is wasted. The new wine is dried up. All the oil, the olive branches are all gone. Be ashamed, you husbandmen. You should have known. You vine dressers, for the wheat and for the barley. That means when you see a lot of times in the Bible, wheat and barley, that's classes. That's rich and poor. The rich people eat wheat. The poor people eat barley. The wheat is gone. The barley is gone. We're all suffering in this one. The vine is dried up. The fig tree is languishing. The pomegranate. Oh, and he goes down through. And you stop and you say, wait a minute. What is going on here? So he asks again, the old men, have you ever seen anything like this before? Ever heard of anything like this before? And then what happens is you run across a few men that are the men of Issachar. They don't need to be told, but their senses have been honed into what God is doing. When God is doing something in your life, he leaves his fingerprints all over the place. Now, he won't show you, and he won't show his hands, and he won't show his feet, and he doesn't part the Red Sea. But he does these little things, and he'll leave his fingerprints all over the place. But only the men of Issachar who knew and had understanding of these things will recognize what is happening. And he is a smart gentleman who is asking the men, have you ever seen anything like this before? And he gets the answer. He gets understanding, because if you look at verse 15, he says, alas! In other words, oh, my God, his hand over his face. This is the day of the Lord. An interesting note is no one knows when Joel has been written. There's nothing in the context that says. We don't know if he was before the exile, after the exile. We have no idea when Joel was written. And that's on purpose, because this book of Joel transcends all of history. It's not about the historical piece. Yes, it was a historical invasion of insects, but that's not really what it's about. So we're not told. We're not going to be history buffs in this one. He's not talking about here. That's not the point. The point that he is making, he's saying, look at all these insects. Aha. He's actually talking about the day of the Lord, a future day, a day of catastrophe, a day that has never been ever before. That's why we have in verse 3, he says, tell your children of it. And that's not good enough, because then he says, let your children tell their children and their children another generation. You have to tell the children what's going on so that when they grow up, they know what to expect when they see these things happening, so that the children will become men of Issachar as well. We have to raise up a generation. That was the problem in Judges. Sometimes I get very frustrated with Christianity, Andy. It just drives me nuts. It is so terrible and so watered down and so disgusting. I mean, it's sickening already. So, for instance, here's the thing. And I think I even have one in my own house, because somebody, I think, bought it for me. Joshua, you know, the Joshua thing. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And they act like that's good. That's terrible. Context of Joshua. What was happening in the end of Joshua? Better yet, what happens after Joshua? Go through your things in the books of the Bible, and so that you can remember that. Joshua, Judges, Ruth. Oh, Judges. Oh, yeah, that's right. Was Judges good? They did that which was right in their own eyes. Why? Because there was no king in the land. Why? Because Joshua didn't set one up. Moses, for how many years as he was running the nation, you find these two names, Joshua and Caleb, with Moses everywhere they went. Setting things up. Watch how I do this. Understand. Get understanding. Because I'm not going to live forever. And so when Moses finally dies, what happens? A perfect transition right to Joshua. Joshua, the servant of the Lord, Moses is dead. Now you take these people over to cross the Jordan and get into the promised land. And it works beautifully. It's a beautiful transition. But you know what Joshua does? Nothing. You know what he says? Well, as for me and my house, we'll serve the Lord. You know what else he means? The rest of them, I can't speak for. Because they're all doing that which is right in their own eyes, because there's no judge, there's no leader, there's no king, there's no Joshua. Joshua never set up the person to take his place. So as for me and my house, we're okay. But the rest of you will perish. You good with that? Do you not see our nation funneling downward? Because if you don't, you got your head in the sand. That's why he says, tell your children of it. Let your children tell their children. And let their children, another generation, let it continue. Because the day of the Lord has not yet happened. Which means it's actually more important for us that are alive today to tell our children, so that our children can tell their children. So when finally the locusts come, we know what to do. Get in the plane and defend the harbor.
You've been listening to Time in the Vineyard with Pastor Teacher Jeff Turing. Today's broadcast was brought to you from the pulpit of Liberty Valley Church, Northfield, Ohio. For more information, you can call the church at 330-554-7606 or check us out on the web at libertyvalleychurch.org. That's libertyvalleychurch.org.